It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is out today. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up at Central Time, we talk to Milwaukee County Executive Chris Abley about how the hotly debated state budget will affect the Milwaukee area. First, all over Wisconsin today, there have been reports of hazy or smoky air. Over the past few weeks, we've heard about smoke from Canadian wildfires making its way to us here in the state. Today seemed particularly bad, so much so that Wisconsin's DNR issued an air quality advisory for all the state's counties. Joining us now with a closer look at why this is happening is Sean Miller with the National Weather Service's office in Milwaukee Sullivan. Sean, thanks a lot for joining us.
Oh, sure thing. Nice to speak with you.
Well, I looked at the National Weather Service forecast for my local area this morning, and I saw the words partly smoky. I don't think I've ever seen that before. How weird, how rare is this that you're having to predict smoke conditions at the Weather Service?
Well, it's something that crops up from time to time. It's certainly not a regular day-to-day kind of thing, but usually it seems like once every, you know, maybe 2, 3, 4 years or so, we get a good enough fire in the region that sort of transports the smoke into our area, and the impacts are enough at the surface that we go ahead and put something into our products so that folks are more aware.
So what kind of conditions are you seeing there in Milwaukee or people seeing around the state when it comes to smoke through the day today?
As far as smoke, from what we've seen, it was primarily western and northern parts of the state that have had the greatest impacts for today and both today and yesterday. We've seen it move a little bit farther southeast behind a cold front kind of move through, and as that happens, we tend to have subsidence and sinking air behind the front, and that sort of helped transport it down to the surface. A little bit further south and east, we've seen reduced visibilities in, for example, the Madison area, parts of south-central Wisconsin earlier today. They're a little bit better, but we're still seeing some of the particulate levels remaining sort of high all the way into the south and central parts of the state this afternoon.
Yeah, I wanted to ask about that. The DNR had issued that air quality alert that I mentioned. So usually would the smoke be expected to just pass overhead and maybe we see it up in the sky? It wouldn't come down here. It takes special conditions to drag it down to where we're going to breathe it in?
Yes, that's correct. We actually have been dealing with it aloft for a little while now, and it has stayed up high. It was just as we got that front through, we need, you know, good sinking motion in the atmosphere. It kind of compresses things, keeps anything that's down near the surface trapped near the surface. That's usually associated with high pressure, which tends to build in after we get a frontal passage.
Now, I've had a couple times in the last couple of days where I smelled smoke, and I thought, oh, somebody's got the wood-fired stove going, and I think, well, it's 70-some degrees. No, they don't. Is it possible that over the last couple of days I could have been smelling those Canadian wildfires here in Wisconsin, or am I just hallucinating?
There have been reports of people smelling them, so that certainly is possible. The greatest odds for that appeared to be mainly northern and western Wisconsin yesterday, and today it looks like we've gotten some reports from that down in south-central Wisconsin. Haven't heard anything really from the far south and east, but it's certainly not out of the question.
Now, this is coming from fires burning mainly, I guess, in Saskatchewan. There are other fires elsewhere in western Canada. Now, I looked online from Saskatoon to Milwaukee. You're talking about a little over 1,000 miles. So is it unusual for smoke from that far away to be affecting us here in the state?
It's not really necessarily unusual. It really just takes a big enough fire to be burning and producing the smoke for a long period of time, and then the right atmospheric conditions to transport it this way. Those fires up there have actually been burning since back in the latter part of May, and just primarily, you know, the transport has been further to the east, so they've dealt with it more in portions of Canada and perhaps some of the bordering states. But we've just been in a favorable regime lately, trough sort of bringing the upper level winds down a little bit further south that's brought it towards us. So, well, it's not something we deal with all the time. Anytime you have a big enough fire, it certainly can happen and has happened before.
Talking to Sean Miller with the National Weather Service. He's in the Milwaukee Sullivan office looking at the smoky conditions in our weather, mostly earlier today, coming from Canadian wildfires, 1,000 miles or so west and a little bit north, if I read the map right. So this isn't just hitting us here in Wisconsin. It's covering a pretty wide area, I think. How wide is this smoke coverage, Sean?
The coverage has been quite wide. I mean, it's affected everybody from a lot of the northern tier states. I mean, Montana down through the plains, the Dakotas, Nebraska, Missouri down as far south as Arkansas, and perhaps even a little bit farther south. And then, of course, east through here, Wisconsin and then Michigan. And the effects have really been pretty wide-reaching with this event.
Now, maybe a crazy question here. As I understand rain formation, it happens when the vapor way up there starts condensing around particles like dust, particulate matter. Could the smoke coming from Canada affect rain, maybe have enhanced the rain we had yesterday?
I probably, although that is within the realm of possibility, I probably wouldn't extend it to yesterday's event, as we already had an atmosphere that was pretty well primed for the precip that we did get. We had a very moist, warm air mass transported northward, so we already had pretty good setup for rain as it is. Could it have had an impact? That's certainly possible, but it would be kind of hard to determine exactly what that would be, and it probably wouldn't be a really large one.
Now, I mentioned looking at my weather this morning. I know the DNR issued the air quality alert. I do see that, I saw that on the National Weather Service forecast, something to be on the lookout for. Are you often looking for possible adverse health impacts of the weather to alert us to?
That's something that's a little bit outside of our area. It's not something we tend to do a whole lot. As you mentioned, usually the state agencies are the ones that are primarily involved in the forecast and of particulates and ozone issues and things like that. However, when we have an event like this, everybody works together, and we do our best to help them get that message out so that more folks are aware of what's going on. So it's something that we always get to brush up a little bit on as well when one of these events takes place.
Now, knock on wood, they're going to get these wildfires under control over there in Canada. But while they keep burning, what will determine whether future smoke paths keep hitting us here in Wisconsin and whether it comes down to the surface again?
It will depend on our large-scale atmospheric patterns. What we really need and what we got before when we brought that smoke down south is, first of all, just to get it over our area, we usually need a good trough to bring the jet stream, sort of pull it south. The jet has to be oriented such that the upper-level winds are transported over the fire region and then dip down southwards to our area in Wisconsin. That'll help bring it down from, those areas and bring it in aloft. But to get it down to the surface, we need something else. We need the surface feature to move through like that cold front did, and then we need a good area of high pressure to build in and sort of allow that sinking motion in the atmosphere that traps the particles close to the surface.
And that smoke did sink close to the surface today. Do we expect that in the next couple of days, or are we a little clearer as far as we can tell right now?
It looks like we're a little clearer in terms of we're taking the smoke trajectories out of the area. We only have a little bit of very weak stuff coming through aloft. We may still have some residual buildup just from the particles that we do have with that high pressure. Anything that doesn't get pushed out with the winds today could remain around a little bit, so it's not entirely impossible that we don't keep the high PM levels at the surface at least a little bit longer, the fine particulates, that is. So that's one thing that we'll definitely want to watch for.
Sean, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Certainly.
That was Sean Miller with the National Weather Service. He's based in the Milwaukee Sullivan office. Join us to talk about the smoky air that's been blowing through the state today from wildfires in western Canada. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the Wisconsin Medical Society recently revised its position on voluntary opt-outs on vaccinations. We'll find out what the changes are and what they mean for parents and public health. First, Milwaukee County has been at the center of a heated state budget debate that's lasted months. The most contentious question has been whether to direct $250 million of public money to a new Milwaukee Bucks arena. That proposal is now out of the budget and in the legislature at large, but other hot-button items are sure to affect the county as well. A decrease in proposed transportation funding, a big cut to the UW system as well. As the budget and the Bucks proposal head to the full legislature, we welcome Milwaukee County Executive Chris Abley to the show. Chris Abley, thanks for joining us.
Great to be here.
So were you disappointed that the Bucks Arena proposal was removed from the state budget to become standalone legislation?
No. I mean, I think this budget, as I'm sure most of your listeners who are political watchers would agree, is one of the more complicated budgets I've seen in Wisconsin in a very long time. There's a lot of differences of opinion where normally people are lined up at this point, and there's a lot of big issues in there. Obviously, the arena is a big one. The way I have talked about that from my standpoint in the county is if there was a federal law that prevented the public funding of any kind of arena or stadium, so there was sort of an even market completely around the country, I'd support that. But until it happens, right now the market is such that a lot of these groups can get can go to places and go to cities where they get these offers of support. And we're not a city that is without a team looking to bring one in. We're a city and a county and a state that has a team that is currently contributing close to $7 million a year just from the income tax. And that doesn't go to the city or the county, it goes to the state. And, you know, Buck's team aside, my concern is if they leave, we have this big budget hole, and we also lose a couple hundred existing jobs, and property values not only don't go up, they probably go down. And an area downtown in Milwaukee called the Park East, which has been largely undeveloped for about 15 years, the undeveloped area gets, frankly, bigger because it gets added to it a zombie Bradley Center with a bunch of liabilities on it. And while there's some disagreement about who would be responsible for the upkeep, I keep pointing out that, you know, we can all sit here and say not it, but somebody's going to have to pay for redevelopment there. So I do see this as an important issue and, frankly, one that can be catalytic. And I do think legislators on both sides have seen that.
You're basically summing up the argument at that presentation early in June that the catchphrase was, it's cheaper to keep them. So $250 million of public money from the state, county, and city levels, budget money scarce at all those levels.
Right.
Is it really worth that investment plus interest down the road to get those benefits you just outlined?
Sure. Yeah, no, it's a great question. I mean, I think people should always ask of any public investment, does this, any incremental new investment of public money, is it worth it? Is it warranted by a return? In this case, I think it's a pretty clear yes. And just to put that in some context, I've been county executive for 4 years, and in that time, I've been restoring social programs like mental health, I mean, millions more every year, child support, programming in the House of Corrections, aging, family care, trying to fill in for transit because our state funding for transit has been cut, and, you know, that's been hard for me to do. So I am laser focused on empowering the neediest and most vulnerable. But I also know that if we lose the bucks, the revenue that goes to the state, it is a big revenue source. And incidentally, it's a revenue source that's going to increase rather significantly. The 200 figure you talked about is over a 20-year period. Over the same period, just the incremental income well exceeds that just from the players. And that's before you get to the increase in property appraisals. You've got thousands of new properties down here, residences that the city has done a wonderful job developing that are now going to be closer to a much more valuable part of downtown they'll be happy about. You bump their appraisals by, say, 5%, 2,500 residences just on the river, just north of downtown. 20 years, 5%, that's an enormous increase without raising any taxes. And why am I excited? It's not about the bucks. That's more revenue for me to continue doing what I've done, which is restore social services. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm a Bucks fan too, but that to me is the argument that's compelling.
Do you think it's a sure thing that the Bucks leave if this deal, as is, isn't struck?
You know, I'm not, I think it would be very likely. I hope that the deal is struck. I hope that's not one of the issues we have to worry about. You mentioned before, one of the other things I and most other cities and counties are looking at is the transportation budget, which has a number of parts that directly affect us. Transit, while it represents a small part of the state transportation budget, here in Milwaukee, about 150,000 rides are given every single day. You know, 19,000 University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, about 43,000 to Milwaukee Area Technical College, all their campuses, about 40,000 every day just to get to work. You know, that's about as important to me as anything. And I noticed that in the governor's proposed budget, they're flat for the first year of the biennium, and I think a small bump in the second year, which might get us back to where we were about 5 years ago.
So another point of criticism in what's happening related to this Bucks deal is you would get from the legislature more authority, more control over land sales of county lands, especially a site close to the Bucks arena. would usually have to go through the board, as I understand it. Did you seek out that enhanced authority from state legislators?
There's a number of things I sought out. In the 4 years I've been here, most years I've been here, I've sought change at the state level, impact in the county. And the reason has always been where I think we can get the best value for the county. So as an example, the first year I was here, I fought for an independently elected comptroller. I liked the idea that the person who certifies numbers doesn't report to me or any county exec, doesn't report to the board. They can be safely independent to say, hey, this is more expensive than you're saying or less. And then last 2 years ago, the mental health board, the creation of the mental health board, which actually removed quite a bit of authority for me, though the goal was about better care for the folks we serve with mental illness. And, you know, 1 year out, we had, for first time in about 15 years, a $10 million surplus, first time in a long time, a decrease in emergency room visits significantly, more community placements, better outcomes. And similarly here, one of the issues that's come up is, what we're proposing is modeled on the way the state does it, the way a number of other counties, including Waukesha, do it. Yes, it is something I sought.
You did seek that. Mm-hmm. We are talking to Chris Abley. He's the county executive in Milwaukee County, talking about budget issues, the Bucks Arena, and other things affecting the state's highest population county. Let's talk a little more about transportation funding. Some highway projects getting delayed in a deal struck to get the budget through the Joint Finance Committee. How are you seeing the transportation budget affecting you there in Milwaukee County?
Well, the biggest project that has everybody's attention in Milwaukee, I mean the city and the county, and probably the broader five-county area, is the Zoo Interchange. One of the reasons it's an issue is that it's the single busiest interchange in the state, about 300,000 riders a day, two, it's in progress. The work there was started a few years ago, and I'm sure many people have seen what's going on there. And at one point, there was some concern that as part of the cuts in the transportation budget, was going to be essentially held up and delayed finishing. And one of the points I was, and my colleagues down here have tried to make to the legislators at the state level is, putting aside for a second the relative merits of spending hundreds of millions of dollars on these projects, and to begin with, I was uncomfortable with $1.3 billion in extra bonding to do it. I don't like that kind of borrowing. I think it hurts future generations. But we've started this project, in addition to being the busiest, it's also right next to the largest regional medical complex and by far the largest level one trauma center in the state. And for a whole lot of areas of medical care, whether you live in Milwaukee or not, the highest level of critical care is right there. So as an added concern, making sure that people can have fast access when they need it is not a hypothetical. It looks like that, as I understand it, in the latest version, that project will continue. But I think the broader issue, as many have noted, is that we're going to need a more sustainable way to fund the transportation budget. And certainly I have a strong bias towards moving a lot more of it towards public transit.
Now, whether we're talking about putting state money into the Bucks Arena or state money into that Zoo Interchange, sometimes there's pushback from the rest of the state. Why are we putting a lot of money into these Milwaukee area, Milwaukee County projects? Do you think that's fair for legislators and citizens around the state to be a little reluctant to sign on to something like that?
Oh, it's a very fair question. I think the answer, the headline of the answer is because 33% of the state revenue that's being spent in Madison is generated in Milwaukee. It's where most of the people, voters, and taxpayers are. And interestingly, I've become more aware of this in the 4 years I've been here, of the shared revenue that goes to all 72 counties, and there's a lot of different streams, but a lot of it is calculated on a per capita basis, and there's a number of those funding formulas where Milwaukee County is uniquely reimbursed at a lower level. That's why I always think it's funny when I hear legislators say, oh, you know, Milwaukee's that sucking sound. I think, well, actually, I think what you mean is more of a gushing sound. And I'm not saying nobody wants Madison or the state legislators to bail us out. I just settled for being at the same level, which, incidentally, until about 30 years ago, the county was, the same per cap level. But regardless, it's also, you know, the highest return on investment. If all we wanted to do as a state is grow the revenue that we can then, as a state, make decisions about the single best investment you could make is in the economic engine of the state, which is here in Milwaukee.
Chris Abley, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You bet. Thanks for having me.
We've been talking to Milwaukee County Executive Chris Abley about how the hotly debated state budget will affect Milwaukee County, the Bucks Arena plan as well. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is out today. There's been a lot of discussion and controversy about childhood vaccines. More and more parents have been opting to either space the shots further apart or skip vaccinating their children entirely. In light of outbreaks of formerly controlled diseases like measles, medical officials across the country are changing how easy it is to delay or opt out of childhood vaccinations. California made news lately with some tougher guidelines, and closer to home, there's a new statement from the Wisconsin Medical Society calling for similar changes. Dr. Patrick Remington joins us. He's a professor and associate dean in the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. He's also a member of the Wisconsin Medical Society's Board of Directors. Dr. Remington, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks, Rob. Good to be back.
Well, let's key in on this statement from the Wisconsin Medical Society. What is it calling for?
Well, the Medical Society doesn't make any laws, but it does provide advice to lawmakers in the state. And that advice is that Wisconsin's current law, which gives parents the right to refuse a vaccine for their children due to religious or personal reasons, should be eliminated. The Medical Society believes that the evidence for safety of the vaccine far outweighs any evidence or research on potential risks. Now, there might be a medical condition that a patient would have that would preclude them from receiving a vaccine, but the change in society toward people opting out of vaccines has led to outbreaks that have now, just in the last few days, discovered there's been a death in measles due to measles from this breakdown in the immunity of the population.
Now, I mentioned the changes in the laws in California. Is what the Wisconsin Medical Society is looking for here in Wisconsin similar to that?
Yeah, exactly. California just enacted a law which includes only medical exemptions from the vaccination. Parents can no longer have personal or religious exemptions.
So let's get back to the basics here. What are the childhood vaccinations that are mandated?
Well, there's a whole laundry list. I don't have access to them sitting in front of me, but they basically begin in infancy. And research has developed a schedule where vaccines against measles, mumps, and rubella can be given safely at the same time. There's vaccines against diphtheria and pertussis, also known as whooping cough, and then more vaccines as children get older.
And who decides which shots need to be given? At what level is that law set? Is this something that the legislature has passed in the past?
Yes. In fact, although there are federal guidelines, the federal government doesn't enact laws. States do that. So each state comes up with the guidelines for the requirement of a vaccine to be given to enter school, for example. But it's really professional organizations like the American Academy of Pediatrics or there's an advisory committee to the federal government that creates those standards, and then it's up to your healthcare provider to set that schedule with the patients.
Talking to Dr. Patrick Remington about vaccinations, California recently made it harder for parents to opt out of mandatory vaccinations for their kids. The Wisconsin Medical Society calling on a similar change here in Wisconsin. So, Dr. Remington, what's the damage if a parent, a family here and there says, I'm uncomfortable with these vaccines, I've read some bad stuff on the internet, we're not going to get our kid vaccinated? What's the damage to public health at large?
Well, it's a classic case of compromising individual rights or responsibilities for the collective good. It's been well demonstrated that as the level of immunization drops in a community from 97% or 98% down to 80% or 70%, that level, which is called the herd immunity, just as in veterinary science, we think about people as a herd protected by those that have been vaccinated. But when that level drops below a certain percentage, now outbreaks can propagate throughout the community. And as we saw this year, I think there have been 180 cases of measles that started in California, predominantly because of the low rates of vaccines. Those low rates allowed the vaccine to spread from person to person and throughout the nation.
And you mentioned medical exemptions. Who can't, who shouldn't get these vaccinations?
Well, again, that'd be specific to each vaccine. In general, people who have immune deficiency are being treated for an illness or don't have a strong immune system. You don't want to provide vaccines, or they may be precluded, particularly vaccines that are live but attenuated or not as virulent. So some people might have reactions to components in the vaccine. That would be another medical reason not to be vaccinated.
And are those the people we worry about if other people aren't getting vaccinated, that they would be now at more risk of getting measles or some other vaccinated illness, especially given their compromised immune system?
Well, that's the reason for the recommendation, that if people do not have a medical exemption, that everyone should be vaccinated. We know that there will be some people who have medical reasons or who, for one reason or another, fail to get vaccinated. And that's why you need to get up to 95 or 90% of the population. We know that there will be some individuals that are not vaccinated. For example, young infants under the age of one will not be routinely vaccinated. So by definition, infants are not immune and are susceptible to these vaccine-preventable diseases.
Now, you mentioned this as a conflict between the public good and the public health on one hand and individual rights on the other. It's fairly rare, I think, that medical treatments are required, are mandatory. What makes this rise to that bar, this thing that we're usually pretty reluctant to do?
Well, it's a great question. And actually, the Supreme Court weighed in on this over 100 years ago when a Swedish immigrant refused to be vaccinated during a smallpox epidemic in Massachusetts. And he was forced to do so, actually fined $5 for not receiving the vaccine. At that time, smallpox killed millions in this country. And it's clear that that does compromise an individual's rights to not be vaccinated. But here's a decision that does affect the health of others. I use an analogy with cigarette smoking. Everybody has the right to smoke cigarettes, but as a society, we've agreed that the smoke shouldn't hurt other people's health. For example, by smoking in an office or in an elevator or in an airplane. That same holds true for vaccines. If an individual chooses not to be vaccinated, in effect, they're compromising the health of others, because if they get sick, it's not just their problem, it becomes other people's problems. They spread that disease to other people who are at risk.
Now, a lot of this conversation is happening because people believe that the vaccines themselves are a health risk for their child. Studies since retracted, debunked in many cases, had pointed towards some ill effects. Again, those were retracted, but the cat's out of the bag there in some ways. Is it possible to turn the tide on what people believe about the ill effects of these vaccines?
Well, it's very difficult. It may have been difficult 20 years ago when this information was provided between a physician and a patient, but now the internet and television and the mass media is full of misinformation. So it is very difficult. You see very credible people who are misinformed about the risks and the balance between the risks and the benefits again, this is an example of the risk. There is a small risk of a reaction to a vaccine, but the balance of the risks between the benefits to the society of not having vaccine-preventable diseases far outweighs the small risk for any individual.
We're talking with Dr. Patrick Remington about the Wisconsin Medical Society's new policy relating to opting out of childhood vaccines. They are calling on state lawmakers to change that policy, make it harder, in effect, to opt out of those mandated vaccines. We want to hear from you. Do you think that public health concerns, the need to protect those who can't get these vaccines, trumps a parent's decision-making for their own child? If you've opted not to vaccinate your kid, what would you need to know to feel that it was a healthy option to get those childhood shots? Should these be mandatory? Should exemptions be limited more than they are now? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also share your thoughts or your questions on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation after a look at the latest news with Kristen Durst. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're continuing our conversation with Dr. Patrick Remington about the Wisconsin Medical Society's new policy relating to opting out of childhood vaccines. They are hoping the state makes it harder for parents to opt out of those vaccines for their kids. And we want to hear from you. Where's the balance between public health concerns and parental choice? Would you like access to information about the vaccination rate at your child's school? What would you do with that info? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. And Dr. Remington, before we go to the callers, that point I just mentioned, access to information about vaccination rates at schools. What kind of access do we have? What would you like to see us have?
Well, that's an interesting question. One approach on an issue like this is to let the customer decide, basically become a smart shopper for your child's school. You could look and say that I don't want my child to go to this school. They only have 60% of the kids are vaccinated, and the risk of an outbreak is higher than in a school with 95%. I actually think that's the wrong approach. Sometimes information is good, but other times having a policy that gets the rate for all kids to a level where the entire school is protected is a much stronger and much more effective approach.
We'll go to our callers now. Daryl is on the line in Ixonia. Daryl, hi.
Hi. My firstborn had all her shots and even for pertussis, which she ended up getting pertussis after having been fully vaccinated. My second child was on a second round of vaccines, and then he had a reaction. So I stopped. And my thirdborn, she was on her first round. That was on the same day that he had his reaction. But, to say that people that stop vaccinating or don't vaccinate are misinformed is, you're kind of poo-pooing everyone. Say, oh, if you don't agree with me, you're misinformed. Well, I consider myself informed, and I think it's a bigger issue than just saying yay or nay. There are other factors. And I certainly don't believe that autism is caused by vaccines, that, and they always say, oh, the people that don't do it, that's what they all believe, so they're all stupid. Well, no, there are, it's a bigger issue than yes or no. There's a lot of factors involved. And I think you're talking down to people that have made a decision, and I certainly don't want the government to come in and say, because then which vaccines do you say? Whatever your doctor says is right, this is the vaccine, and this is the day, and this is what you must do. Is that how it's going to be?
All right, Daryl, thanks for the call. So first, his main concern, not the autism fears, but fears of those reactions, which, as you say, Dr. Remington, do happen in some cases.
Well, I think the caller makes a great point that, first of all, this shouldn't be minimized. This is a very important issue. It involves potentially fatal diseases that can be prevented. I also agree that we shouldn't minimize that vaccines come with a very small risk, but kids can have an immune reaction, an allergy, and it's just for that very reason that kids who are able to get the vaccine should do so without parents having a personal preference not to. Because there may be a child, like the caller's son, who has an immune reaction or an allergy, and they then stop getting the vaccine. If they go to school where 95 or 98% of the kids have had the vaccine and are up to date, his son or daughter will be protected by the herd and by others who've made this choice to help the community. So I think I don't intend to minimize the fact that it's a scary thing to do for a parent. We have four kids. Our kids were vaccinated. We had a child with a reaction to one of the vaccines, and he couldn't finish the series because of that. And we were glad that he went to schools where others had completed the series and has been free of these diseases because of that.
Daryl, thanks for the call. We'll go now to Jocelyn in Sheboygan. Jocelyn, hi.
Yes, hi. I was wondering if diabetes is a factor for being more susceptible to measles or whatever, you know, chickenpox or pertussis. And I'm a person that has diabetes, but I also had all those diseases and had shots, you know, at the polio shot. But I had chickenpox, I had measles, and pertussis, I had whooping cough. So does that mean that I'm immune from these diseases or...
Jocelyn, thanks for the call. So diabetes putting us at any greater or lesser risk of these diseases, first of all, Dr. Remington?
Well, sometimes chronic illnesses are a reason to actually be more likely to be vaccinated because things like influenza for a person with a chronic illness can be very severe. So those guidelines are very specific about whether you have a chronic illness and whether vaccines are recommended or not. The caller also mentioned the question of for older people who were living during a time when measles went through the community and everybody got sick. Those of us who survived have lifelong immunity, and so that's the bad thing is that many people got sick, many people were hospitalized, and some died during the 50s and 60s, or were disabled for life, for example, from polio. But those who did survive and had the childhood diseases do have lifelong immunity.
Jocelyn, thanks for that call. We're talking to Dr. Patrick Remington about vaccines. He's on the board of the Wisconsin Medical Society, which is looking for the state, asking the state to tighten up its guidelines on who can opt out of mandatory vaccines, make it harder, in effect, to opt out. You can join in with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. Now, Jocelyn mentioned having had pertussis. Daryl mentioned his kid had had pertussis after getting the vaccine. I wanted to ask Dr. Remington, is it possible sometimes, even after having the vaccine, to get at least some of these illnesses?
Yes, absolutely. No vaccine is 100% effective. Some vaccines are known to be less effective than others. So pertussis is a good example. Maybe 70 or 80% of the kids who are immunized are protected, but a certain portion are still at risk. Again, that makes even more reason for having herd immunity, for bringing the level of vaccination up to 90 or 95 or even 98%. Because the vaccines aren't perfect, there will be a small percentage of the vaccinated population that's still at risk. So, yes, vaccines are effective, but they're not perfect.
Back to our callers now with Terry in Minnesota. Terry, hi.
Hi. I have a comment. I don't want to say that autism was caused by my son's vaccine because I have no proof of that. I do know that he was developing normally until his two-year-old shots, and about a week later he started wearing 10 layers of clothes and would only eat yogurt for the following year. It didn't take long to figure out that he had developed autism. So that's not to say I'm not in favor of vaccines. I am 100% in favor of vaccines, even with that knowledge. What I think we need to do is look at how do we make them safer so that any of the things that are questionable in them can be eliminated, and we still have a more effective vaccine, if you will.
Terry, thanks for the call. Dr. Remington, we hear this from parents whenever we talk about vaccines. Around the time a kid got a certain vaccine, they showed their first signs of autism. Is there cause and effect, or are these things happening around the same time but unrelated?
There are a few things that have been researched more than the link, the putative link between vaccines and autism. Anything you do very often, like vaccines, vaccines are given every day of the year. Anytime you do that, you will think that there's a cause and effect relationship. Typically, people who get sick think about the last meal that they ate and think that that caused them to get sick. So this has been researched extensively, and there is no link between vaccines and autism. There are, though,
ways to make vaccines safer, and research is continuing. And so I think you can have both policies that require parents to vaccinate their kids, except for medical reasons, and continued funding for research to make vaccines even safer than they are today.
Setting aside the health and public health sides of things, this is going to be a political issue. Legislators would have to pass a law changing the vaccination requirements. As we wrap up, do you think that they'll listen to the Wisconsin Medical Society and do that?
Well, I do. I think the trend in California is a trend that we'll see around the country, particularly from parents of kids who are at risk when others choose not to be vaccinated. So I think it will be hotly debated, but I think the best thing to do is to think about public health, think about what you can do for the entire community, and vaccinate your kids.
Dr. Remington, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That was Dr. Patrick Remington, professor and associate dean in the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. He's also a member of the Wisconsin Medical Society's board of directors. He joined us to talk about the Wisconsin Medical Society's recent statement calling for a change in state policy when it comes to opting out of mandatory childhood vaccinations.